Welcome to today's program titled Proving Up Trade Secret Misappropriation, Best Practices and Tales from the Trenches. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your questions that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for today's webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation. That will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Saifar Shaw's legal disclaimer is now displayed on your screen. Please note that. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to Jim McNary. You may begin.
All right, thank you. Good morning and good afternoon for those of you on the East Coast. We have a great program today. It's full of content, and so we will try to move through quickly while still providing you the coverage that you need to understand today's topic. I'd like to briefly introduce my co-presenters. Justin Beyer is a partner in Seyfarth Shaw's Chicago office. He's a commercial litigator, and he has extensive experience in trade secret and non-compete work, as well as computer fraud. I am in the Sacramento and San Francisco offices of Seyfarth Shaw, and I'm a partner specializing in trade secret enforcement and protection, computer fraud, and non-competes. And Jim Vaughn is from iDiscovery Solutions. Jim has decades of experience in computer forensics and investigations. The topics that we'll be covering today, frankly, a good time could be spent on each one of these bullet points, but we're trying to give you a meaningful overview of each of them so that you have a good takeaway from the topics we're covering to allow you to substantively address the topics and protect and, where necessary, prosecute the trade secrets that are valuable to your organization. So briefly, we'll address what are trade secrets. There'll be a brief discussion of the newly enacted Defend Trade Secrets Act, steps to help prevent misappropriation, how to identify misappropriation and preserve evidence. You'll see a number of slides that Jim Vaughn will roll through. There'll be a fair number of technical terms there, but Jim does a fantastic job both in gathering evidence, but also in testifying at deposition and at trial, for that matter, in making usable and simple computer forensics such that lawyers and laypeople can make use of the information. Litigation considerations. Once you've identified potential misappropriation and you want to pursue a misappropriator, what are the next steps and considerations? And you'll see each of those bullet points there, which we will address briefly. So with that, I'm going to turn over the presentation to Justin Beyer.
Thanks, Jim. As Jim mentioned, we're going to start the presentation today talking about what is a trade secret, because without really defining what that is, we're not really in a position to know how to protect it. So the initial place that you start is that a trade secret has various generally statutory definitions. Vast majority of the states in the United States have codified something referred to as the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And there's also now the Defend Trade Secrets Act, through which trade secret is also defined, and that's at a federal level. But effectively, a trade secret is broken down into a series of tests. And the first is, it has to be information that is generally not known to others. It has to provide some sort of monetary, it must have the ability to provide monetary gain for the company, and there has to be reasonable efforts to maintain that secrecy. Very often you hear stories about a trade secret being the secret sauce of a company, and in many cases that can be the case. There's litigation from the 80s in which the recipe for Coca-Cola was litigated, but it doesn't always have to be a bet the company secret. There are a variety of other things that can constitute a trade secret. It doesn't need to be novel or unique. It doesn't have to have some sort of intellectual property registration, such as registering it with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. But there are certain keys. It has to be effectively something that is maintained within your organization on a need-to-know basis. And the people who can know that can be extensive or they can be minimal, but it has to be effectively something that is protected in your industry. It can be known by more than one company, but it has to be something that is effectively protected or reasonably protected within your company. And it can be made up of things that are not trade secrets. For example, very often there is the classic example of the customer list. A customer list isn't something that you can necessarily find in a phone book, though parts of a customer list may be found in a phone book or online. Generally speaking, it contains additional information beyond that that isn't known publicly, or it is a series of publicly available pieces of information that are put together in a unique way that provides then a monetary benefit to the company. In order to adequately address whether something is a trade secret or not, a court is going to ask certain questions, amongst which are the extent it's known outside the company, extent it's known within the company, the measures taken to protect the secrecy, the value of the trade secret, the time, effort, money expended in developing it, and the ease of or difficulty in which another company can recreate the information. Handling these type of cases, I will tell you that where courts generally focus are on those first three points. The extent is known outside the company, extent is known in the company, and the measures taken to protect the secrecy. What it means to be not generally known is that it shouldn't be information that one can find within the public. For example, if you're going to claim that a white paper written and available online as a trade secret, you're going to have a very difficult time demonstrating that. The court is also going to ask the question of, does it provide an economic value to your company? For example, if you're claiming trade secret protection in a series of emails, and for whatever reason those emails are forwarding along happy birthday messages or passing along the latest meme, then you're not going to really have the opportunity to show that that provides any kind of economic protection. The not generally known category of information, however, doesn't require that the information be held completely in secrecy within your company. For example, oftentimes the information that you have may be customer preferences. And oftentimes, the defendant in the case may argue, well, it clearly can't be a trade secret because the information was collected from a third party and the information really belongs to the third party. That's really sort of the classic red herring when it comes to trade secrets. That can be a trade secret, but you'll have to show that you take reasonable steps to protect that information. Confidentiality agreements, non-compete agreements, confidentiality agreements with the customer indicating that this kind of collected information is confidential. Pricing could fall into that category of information. You just have to generally show that you're taking reasonable measures to protect the information. I just mentioned, for example, confidentiality agreements, but there's also other things. Information security is really a hot button issue with courts these days. It's not enough these days simply to have password protection for your computers or key cards for your buildings. That's sort of the minimal threshold. The court expects that to be the case. It's just general business security. There are other things that they're going to be looking for. Do you have internal policies which indicate that email is meant to be used for work purposes only and you're prohibited from sending out documents to your personal email account? Are there confidentiality reminders when you log into your computer? Are you having periodic or semi-periodic review sessions where HR is reminding your employees what the company considers to be confidential information or a trade secret, or helping the employee to actually understand that? Are you monitoring the activity of your employees, such as upon exiting the company, are you running forensics on their computers to determine whether they plugged in third-party media devices? Not all of those things are required, but the court will take those into consideration as demonstrating that you are taking adequate steps to protect the information. And again, absolute secrecy is not required. I mentioned this before. It just has to be reasonable steps. There's nothing that a company can truly do to prohibit the misappropriation of information. And frankly, misappropriation of information isn't going to destroy the secrecy necessarily. It can, but it generally requires the company to sit on its rights and fail to take affirmative action to try to protect those secrets. Earlier this year, the federal government also codified a federal statute that attempts to define trade secrets at a federal level. That's the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which works as an amendment to the Economic Espionage Act. Through this act, it permits a plaintiff to have a federal cause of action and sue directly in federal court on a trade secret claim. So there needs to be no diversity in that circumstance. There are some unique differences between the Defend Trade Secrets Act and what is generally available through a state's adoption of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. For example, in many states have adopted what's known as the Inevitable Disclosure Doctrine. And in the Inevitable Disclosure Doctrine, effectively in the absence of a non-compete agreement, the court can restrict an employee from performing services on behalf of the competitor in instances in which the employees or former employees' duplicitous conduct, essentially conduct that is meant to deceive their former employer, puts the court in a position where it sees the employee as unable to protect those secrets and likely to, quote, inevitably disclose the information. Additionally, there is a secondary section of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which also disallows a court from enjoining someone from being able to perform a job with the new employer. So effectively, there's two aspects of it. There's the aspect where the Inevitable Disclosure Doctrine cannot form a basis for the cause of action. And the secondary part is within the statute itself. It prohibits the court from enjoining them from holding that position. So the Defend Trade Secrets Act does not have as far a reach as generally the state causes of action are. So those considerations should be taken, should be considered before filing a Defend Trade Secrets Act claim. Moving on, and beyond the definition of what a trade secret is, there is the question of what early warning signs are available in order to help a company protect those trade secrets. And generally speaking, you want to be very mindful of employees who are in certain roles where they have access to sensitive trade secrets. Generally speaking, that can be management positions, it can be sales representatives. In certain circumstances, it could be people with a research and development position. But if those folks are leaving, there should be certain steps put into place on a systematic basis for asking questions as they leave. We generally refer to that as the exit interview. And in the exit interview, you want to ask questions such as where they're going to work. You want to confirm that they've returned all of the electronic media devices the company has provided them, be that a laptop computer, a cell phone, a tablet, any external media devices like a USB drive or an external hard drive. You want to ask them questions or you want to remind them of any non-compete obligations, things of that nature. The additional thing is that, and this is a harder part for companies to do on an employee level basis, but there also have to be measures put into place to attempt to prohibit and keep under consideration, that the aspect of third-party hacking. We're not really going to touch on that in my section today, but that is a consideration. If there is a concern that an employee has left and has misappropriated trade secrets, and some of the triggering events for that may be that the individual takes, say, the same or substantially same position with a competitor, the company suddenly sees certain key customer accounts that had been assigned to the departing employee moving to their competitor where there hadn't been such a situation in the past. You want to take certain steps to attempt to identify whether trade secrets have taken place or misappropriation has taken place. We already talked about the exit interview, but other things that can be done are forensic investigation of the individual's computer. And Jim Vaughn is going to talk about that in a little bit, but essentially there are a variety of places where information can be taken. It can be through third-party email accounts. It can be through plugging in electronic devices into the computer. It can be through uploading sensitive documents into a cloud-based account. There are a variety of ways in which that can take place, and there are a variety of tools that a company can utilize either internally or through a third-party provider to check on those. In the exit interview, and just diving into this a little bit deeper, if the employee is willing to provide information about where they're going, you want to ask questions about what their role will be. You want to ask them deeper questions about their duties and responsibilities. You want to get a sense of whether your information is going to be put at risk through their employment with this company. You want to, again, inform them of their continuing obligations. And oftentimes, it is a very good thing to consider to send along a reminder letter to both the employee and the new employer attaching any non-compete agreement or confidentiality agreement and reminding both the employee and the new employer of the former employee's confidentiality obligations. If someone's leaving and there may not be necessarily an initial belief that they're misappropriating the information, companies should still take steps to preserve the ability to analyze information at a later time if it becomes obvious that this employee is breaching their obligations to the company. It has gotten to a point where hard drives are fairly cheap to replace in laptops, and we would recommend that you, at a minimum, pull the hard drive in the proper manner, but pull a hard drive and preserve that, usually for 6 to 9 months. We would also recommend that any automatic deletion policies that exist for a departing employee's emails be either removed or something done to preserve those emails, because very often emails are can prove to be incredibly essential in prosecuting a trade secret misappropriation case. The same holds true for cell phones. If they have a company cell phone, you're going to want to ask them and get the password for it, and you're going to want to make sure that the phone remains active, or at least forensically imaged so that you can preserve any text messages or other information on the phone. I cannot tell you the number of times where text messages prove to be a gold mine from an evidentiary standpoint later on. And you want to also, as soon as you receive notice from the employee, if they're going to a competitor, if they have alerted you that they're going to a competitor, or if they refuse to tell you where they're going, you want to cut off their access to company information immediately. It doesn't mean that you don't accept their two-week notice. It doesn't mean that you don't have them on the payroll for the additional 2 weeks, but you make sure that they stop having access to the information. What do you do next if you suspect trade secret misappropriation? Well, we talked a lot about this already, but you want to interview coworkers. You want to examine email activity. You want to do keyword searches of the email for the competitors, for key customers. You definitely want to conduct a forensic examination, and that'll be talked about a bit later. There are things you can do, text records. You definitely want to ask your employees to keep their ear to the grindstone. Want to know whether or not there's anything out there showing that this former employee is out there competing. It's worth checking social media accounts. I would say that that is not usually a place where you see this type of information, but if you suddenly see a number of customers contacting them via Facebook or LinkedIn, it may be worth looking into in greater detail. And with that, I'm going to turn over the presentation to Jim Vaughn, who is going to provide a deeper dive on the digital forensics that can be that a company can take.
Thank you, Justin. I do see that one person typed a question into the box, so please, we do encourage you to type in questions, and at the end of the presentation, based on time limits, we will try to answer those as much as possible. So, thank you, Justin. So, in regards to digital forensics, you did hear Justin touch on some things. So, this segment is, as Jim McNary mentioned at the beginning, it's a lot of scary words, it's technical, et cetera, but I'm not trying to turn you into forensic experts. We can work on that tomorrow. But for today, I just want to get you thinking about areas to look for, things to look for, things to quarantine, some of the things that I have listed here on this slide here are laptops and desktops, mobile devices. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Some email sources, portable media, and other electronic media. Some of these are things that you're used to dealing with every day in your line of work, so you're very familiar with some of these. Other things you may not be as familiar with. As an example, when I say other media, one thing that comes to mind is, for example, online databases that have to do with Salesforce. I'll just use Salesforce as an example. If you have a salesperson leave your company or your client's company and they are a heavy user of Salesforce and there's, you know, confidential information such as pricing and things of that nature in there, those are things that you want to consider as well. I won't be able today to tell you all of the various things that are available in something like Salesforce, but the important thing for you to remember is to not overlook things that the employees have access to. So what are some of the reasons and what are the things you are going to do here is you certainly want to keep chain of custody. You heard Justin recommend that pulling hard drives, which is in fact a common thing that clients do. I would caution you on one thing, and that is remember that the hard drive you're pulling is married to the computer you're pulling it from. So why is that important? It's important because the computer you're pulling the hard drive from has its own brain. It tells you what the day and time is when you hover down in the bottom right corner. Sometimes it's displayed. If you don't document that, then you can't match it up to the actual hard drive later on during your investigation. So just note that you have to make sure that you document the computer date and time of when the hard drive is being pulled, so that you can marry that up later. Some other things you've heard, removable devices. USB thumb drives are still a pretty common way of taking data. You can take a bunch of stuff. File transfers. Cloud computing is becoming really popular now. So when we're talking about email, you do want to understand what the abilities are with your company in regards to the email and cloud computing. For example, if you're using Office 365, do they have the option to perform certain searches? What logs may be available to show people accessing the email? Things of that nature. That's a little bit different than if you have the email stored on the laptop itself. These are just questions that you will want to ask or have your consultant ask on your behalf. Network access, you heard the recommendation to cut off network access. But in addition to cutting off network access, you want to make sure that you maintain any sort of records. For example, if you have VPN access, that could play an important part in showing that somebody who may be working remotely or from their house, whether or not they were logging in through VPN to download data. And Were they able to VPN through something other than the work laptop? These are all things you want to investigate. Other methods I have on here, Skype, FTP, social media. You actually can attach files, for example, inside a Skype communication. And therefore, these are just things that you also may want to consider as a corporate platform. Do they have Skype or do they have Yammer, for example? Do they have other types of instant messaging platforms or social media platforms where files can be sent back and forth? Personal email usage, what is the policy around that? If people are allowed to use personal email, which most places are, could emails be sent to personal email with attachments? Things like that. You also want to consider destruction of data. I know I've worked on several cases with CyFarth where we've gotten the computer and we see some weird things. I'm going to cover a case scenario for one example today, but just generally overall, you want to look to see if data was destroyed, if the hard drive was wiped, reformatted, things like that. And then you also want to audit your IT systems. Is there anything missing? I have had cases where we've done forensic analysis on laptops, as an example, and they show pointers back to a server. We then go to get the server, and the server is literally missing from the building. It was mysteriously returned a couple weeks later. So that has happened. Beware of that. And we mentioned earlier, again, I know that people will have a tendency to kind of read through the slide, and that's fine. But the gist of this here is to just help you understand in layman's terms what is a link file. A link file is just it's a shortcut. For example, if I plug in a thumb drive and I open up a document from a thumb drive on my Windows computer, it will create what's called a shortcut or a link file. And the reason this is valuable is because it will allow the examiner to provide a list to you to show you a list of files that were opened from a connected USB drive, whether or not you have that USB drive. Now, this won't tell you a complete list of every file that might be on the USB drive, but it will tell you what files were opened from that USB drive so that you can go and request that device if it was not turned in by the user prior to them leaving. And also, inside these shortcuts, it can tell you, you know, different things like, the size of a file, when it was created. I gave you a very good example at the bottom where it just shows here that a Kingston USB device was inserted, and also where a data sheet not for public release was also accessed from this USB device. Jump list, again, is very similar to a link file. It's, again, you can call it shortcut. So in your daily conversations, and if you want to talk to your consultant or you want to talk to other people internally, you just know you're looking for shortcuts. One caution I like to give clients is be careful what you ask your IT staff to do when you are interested in determining this type of activity. The inclination is to have instant gratification and understand what happened right then, right there. And most IT folks will tell you that they are not forensic experts. We are not IT experts. We complement each other. We don't do each other's jobs. And the reason I want everybody to know this is because if you have your IT power up a laptop or go onto a private network folder on their server prior to a forensics person being involved, it can indeed alter things and later on down the line may actually work against you rather than help you. Here's another example again of a shortcut. Excuse me. The reason I highlight this example here is you see that if you look at the full path area, and all I really want you to look at is the letter. You'll see that the top entry has a letter E, and the next entry below it has a letter C. The C represents the actual hard drive of the laptop. The E actually represents a a thumb drive or USB device that was inserted to the computer. Now, some people believe that if you have a copy on the C drive or the laptop that has the same name of the document from the E drive, that it is indeed the same document. It may very well be the same document, but do not make that assumption. And the reason I say that is because I have had clients that have been happy just reviewing or knowing that they've looked at the copy on the hard drive and not gone after the thumb drive. So I just want to point that out to you. Next, again, shell bag. These are, in layman's terms, these are folders. So in other words, we have the ability as forensic examiners to identify for the client if certain folders were open. Again, this doesn't necessarily mean that the folders were misappropriated, copied USBs, etc. They could have been, but not necessarily. This, in essence, is for you to help have an understanding that within the last week of employment, what did this person do? What were they looking at? What were they copying? What were they printing? Etc. Now, here's an example of why I include this is because, as you can see at the bottom, if you just look, most of you, I assume every, probably all of you are familiar with Dropbox. Now, Dropbox is a third-party solution that allows you to upload and download data from, quote, the cloud. Now, Dropbox arguably is not in the care, custody, and control of the company itself, unless it's a company Dropbox, but is arguably in the control of the user while the data resides in somebody's server somewhere in the cloud. So the distinction here is that if there's evidence of your employee putting stuff into Dropbox, that's a big problem for you because it's not in a corporate server, it's outside the corporation, and also there's a sync option, and therefore the last bullet item there where you says it's the intentional and unintentional exfiltration. Now, this is not designed for me to opine on what the intent is or not of an individual. My point here is this. When you set up Dropbox, you enter your credentials, and you can set it to synchronize to your computer. If you leave and you go to a new company and you have the same Dropbox credentials, you can maybe unintentionally or intentionally now synchronize that Dropbox account to your new computer or to a home computer. And therefore, whatever was in the Dropbox account is now synchronized onto those other devices, i.e. your data. And so that is something you have to be aware of. There are many, many, many different file sync and share apps. I was just using Dropbox as one example. Here's an example, again, not making you a forensic expert, but here's an example of how you can tell that Dropbox was used. The Windows prefetch is just an area that basically tells you programs were ran. In this case, it shows Dropbox was ran. It tells you on what dates. And then it also gives you a list of folders that are part of this Dropbox synchronization. Again, good evidence to show that things, for example, schematics, data sheets, and the like are in a Dropbox account. So let's just recap some of the things we talked about. Some of the artifacts I've talked about are link or shortcuts. Link files and jump files are synonymous with shortcuts in layman's terms. We've talked about shell bags, which are folders. So you have shortcuts, you have folders. We talked about installing and using applications. Dropbox was my one example. We've talked about the insertion and uses of USBs and how important those can be in your investigations. Corporate email I've talked about. One thing I will talk about, mention in corporate email, was don't overlook archives and or backups of email. I've seen cases where the client will have a laptop and they say, oh yeah, there's the emails on the laptop, but what it turns out is that the company itself has a email archiving solution, and we could have gotten a more complete set of email from the archiving solution as opposed to just the computer itself. Personal email we've talked about. We've talked cloud service applications. We've talked about wiping the computer. And we like to use checklists. For example, I have one publication for those that are practicing California, specific to California, but put out by the Trade Secret Litigation Protection in California, the third edition is put out by the Intellectual Property Section of the State Bar of California. And that has an actual kind of a checklist for you to documentation through considering encryption and password, considering metadata, considering the movement of your data, where things can be, where it can go, and all of that. So that's another reference point when I talk about checklists. Here is just kind of a, if you take the, and I know what Jim McNary and I like to do as a first pass is, let's do a high-level look into, just a look under the hood, but not necessarily deep diving for cost concerns. Let's do a high level. So if we keep that in mind, when we look at installation of cloud solutions like Dropbox, we look at what folders may have been accessed, we look at what files may have been copied to connected devices. If we looked at what USBs were inserted at the time, copied, etc., this here gives you kind of a timeline and what your storyboard would look like for your first pass analysis on timeline. Now, some of the other things, I'm going to kind of speed this along because I want to give Jim plenty of time for his section, but some of the things to consider is not to overlook things such as setting your expectations. For example, was the hard drive reformatted before you got the computer by the IT department or by the user, which we've seen? Was there new things installed? If so, that can affect your analysis. So you want to look at some of that stuff up front. When was the subject employed and or terminated? And does the data you're analyzing appear to be in accordance with your understanding? So, for example, I expected X, but I found Y and Z. And I'm going to skip through, in general, what I want to show you here is this slide. And I see, and I apologize because we don't get the effect of coming in, but the gist of this was a case where we found evidence that there was a USB device used, but the data on the USB device and the time, the dates and timestamps on the USB device wasn't making sense. And we looked at the computer itself, we looked at some event logs, and we saw that there was some event logs that were funny. Long story short, what had happened was the user plugged in first they changed their computer time, then they plugged in the USB drive. After they changed the time, the clock back on the computer, they reformatted the hard drive, and they then started putting new data on the USB device to make it appear that everything was good, right? Well, the fatal flaw they made is while they were doing this, they were doing this activity in, I believe it was 2011 or 2009. While they were doing this, they were actually cruising the site and looking at pictures of the Dennis Rodman being inducted to the Hall of Fame. So in other words, what they were trying to represent was that the activity on the USB drive happened a year and 3 days earlier, but they were actually looking on the internet at a live event that was occurring at the time. Therefore, would be impossible for those dates and times to match up. So a lot of analysis to get to that, but they ended up spoliating, to use the legal term. They ended up spoliating data. And then I talked about data destruction and other anti-forensics. And so with that, Jim, I will turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, Jim. There's a ton of useful information that Jim just went over, and to give a couple examples of how this plays out in addition to the example that Jim just gave, one of the important things in assessing your risk of whether or not misappropriation has occurred and pursuing potentially enforcement via litigation is to size up the potential misappropriator. How sophisticated are they? And here are a couple examples of relatively sophisticated misappropriators. One, I've had a case where the misappropriator was actually very savvy and was serving in an IT function and generating code that was used in part of the engineering for flash devices. When he went to steal the company's trade secrets, he timed it such that he was exfiltrating, taking data out of the company's servers during a Windows system update. And so he timed the export of data to be masked by a Windows update. And what he did was open a FTP site, a file transfer protocol, such that the really key, highly valuable trade secrets were exported to this FTP during a Windows update. And it made it difficult to see that he did that. Obviously, we did see it, and he got in big trouble. Another simpler example that is more problematic for what I would call laypeople misappropriators is with the proliferation of bring your own devices to work in the employer-employee context. We have seen increasingly where folks, for example, will use an iPad. And on their iPad, they have multiple email accounts. So, for instance, while the iPad is actively being used and the employee is checking their work email, they open the work email. In it is sensitive information. While that email is open, they switch accounts to, for example, a Gmail or Yahoo account, and then forward that email to that personal account. In the absence of having that device, depending on how your email systems are configured and set up, if you're looking only through the servers of the employer and not at that actual device, there have been instances in which we can't see that forward. So in the absence of that device, you would not see that actual email was forwarded. So those are just a couple examples of real-world forensics that become highly important in trade secret cases. You have to remember that trade secret cases, and there's a good body of law on this in most jurisdictions, particularly in California, trade secret litigation relies as much or more than other types of litigation on circumstantial evidence. And so telling a story, a persuasive story with useful evidence, is really important. In the example that Jim gave about Dennis Rodman, this was a case that we worked on together. And it just so happens that not only were the forensics showing this data dissembling or disruption and intentional resetting of the clock on the hard drive to make things look as if they were different than they were from a timing perspective, this particular individual was doing this after he had received a cease and desist and preservation letter from us. So we could show to the court, we sent this preservation letter to this guy. After receiving the preservation letter, he turned around and began manipulating the computer that we said don't touch and dissembling data, offloading data, and essentially doing the exact opposite of what we asked him. And so that's another example of why it's really important to take a comprehensive approach, a thoughtful approach, a detailed, purposeful approach, time allowing, to really frame up your case if you're going to pursue trade secret litigation. Which brings me into the final segment of our presentation today. I'll walk through this pretty quickly because, frankly, we could spend hours on this, but I want to give you some high-level perspectives about what's most important in my view. So, injunctive relief, which court to file in, and early discovery. It's really important for purposes of telling the story, and these slides, the pictures on these particular slides, I think are important and say a little bit more than might initially appear. The puppet master and then the guy taking off with the idea like a rocket. We always like to try to tell the story of the misappropriator, particularly where the misappropriator is going from one employer to another, that they are acting for a larger purpose. That is, if you want to sue the onboarding company, the company to which he or she has joined, it's important to draw connections between the misappropriator and the corporate entity. And then this guy blasting off with his idea in the form of a light bulb. Oftentimes you'll hear in trade secret misappropriation litigation, head start. The misappropriator wanted a head start. They didn't want to put in the work. They want to get a quick jump using someone else's valuable intellectual property to go to market. Before I go to the next slide, I would be remiss if I didn't give you today's CLE code. Let me do that before I forget. The number is SS, like Seyfarth Shaw, so SS9731. One more time, SS9731. All right. So it's critically important to assemble the right team. The right team equals a group of declarants, because if you're going to move for injunctive relief, you need to tell a compelling, simple, clean story that a busy judge is going to be able to digest on short notice. Most often, the team consists of HR that will help establish when the particular employee came on board, the agreements he or she signed, the policies to which they were subject, including computer use policies, non-disclosure agreements, and the like. The employee's managers, what projects were they working on? What was important to the entity? What were the changes in behavior and his or her behavior before they gave notice? Persons who can establish the existence of the claimed trade secret. So you don't need to have a PhD-level scientist, but if, for example, it's a customer list case, you need to establish in terms that could be used in court the elements that Justin laid out for us at the beginning of today's talk. Internal and external IT, folks who can establish an internal chain of custody. Where was this information when it was taken? Was it on the C drive of the laptop that was issued? Did it come out of the server? Was it emailed out of that laptop somewhere else? Of course, external computer forensics experts like Jim Vaughn, he can, and others like him, can establish a level of objectivity to the court. So take the personal interest out of internal IT and turn it into very persuasive facts and evidence, this circumstantial evidence surrounding the circumstances of departure, the potential misappropriation, in terms that the court can feel comfortable with, to know that the chain of custody is reliable, the evidence is authenticated, and that someone objective has assessed the information and can be relied on. Of course, in-house and external counsel, that reminder of obligations and cease and desist letter that I made reference to, sometimes our clients will choose to send them, and sometimes they won't. In those instances where those letters are not sent, that's a judgment call, but sometimes the risk is so high that the client will choose simply to sue as opposed to trying to give the alleged misappropriator a chance to stand down or return the information. Preservation demand is absolutely critical for the reasons that are probably apparent to most everyone, but including some of the tales from the trenches that Jim went through. Private investigators, sometimes they're warranted, sometimes they're not. If you have a computer forensics professional like Jim with a background in law enforcement, you're sometimes killing two birds with one stone, but sometimes there are facts in a case, for example, independent theft of tangible property, of funds, where a private investigator can come in handy. Or maybe the person is lying after they gave their two-week notice. Maybe they were going directly to the offices that they established to compete against you with your own trade secrets. Maybe they were already working for the new employer. So those are instances in which a private investigator may add value. Key events, going back to this notion of a timeline, Jim had a nice graphic of the timeline from a forensics perspective. This is a broader timeline. Things that have been useful in the past and expressed interest in leaving. You know that because they've said it at work, or maybe you see after the fact and looking through email where the person is actively out there in market looking for another job, or maybe they're even competing against you, but they're still employed by you, but you didn't know that. Change in work-related behavior, internal-facing communications, market-facing communications. Timing of accepting new employment, often very critical. What if the employee, while still employed by you without giving notice, has in fact accepted employment and continues to work for you? What if they announce and don't give 2 weeks, but in the 2 weeks before that, they were cobbling together every bit of valuable information they could get their hands on? Computer forensics help do a fact check, truth serum, so to speak, to stories that hopefully you're hearing on the way out in an exit interview. Change in conduct pre- and post-preservation demand. We've been through some examples of that. So picking the right court, this is not an easy, frankly, decision. There are pros and cons, both to federal and state court, and really is fact-intensive depending on your particular circumstances. So there's a lot that can be said for this, and I won't belabor it. But in both courts, you want to pick the court that you think you have the highest possibility of success, simply put. And that can mean different things in different cases. But if injunctive relief is your goal, which in most cases it is, the only thing worse than not moving for a TRO is moving for one and losing. And so it's really important to think about where you're going to file and what your rate of success is going to be and doing it right the first time. The Defend Trade Secrets Act, that is a ticket, I say here, to federal jurisdiction. And, you know, there was a question posed, why would you file in federal court as opposed to state court, given the similarities in federal and state law? And we have oodles of material on the Defense Trade Secrets Act, but just quickly, the Defend Trade Secrets Act provides a seizure provision, very rarely used so far, in which on a truly ex parte basis, in extraordinary circumstances, one can in fact seize the trade secrets that are imminently about to be destroyed or probably more likely to leave the country or go into a competitor's hands or foreign actor's hands. That really, I think, is what the legislative history suggests about seizures, seizure orders under the DTSA. That is not available under the Uniform Trade Secret Act states. The notion of preemption, that is preemption of a Trade Secret Act over state law that and state claims that relates to similar conduct, that is the taking of information that might be some type of business tort or unfair competition. California, for example, has a very, very robust preemption doctrine where the California Uniform Trade Secret Act will preempt the claims such as conversion of confidential data, tortious interference based on the use of confidential data, unfair competition based on the use of confidential data. And so far, the federal act has not been litigated enough to have a strong preemption body of common law flowing out of interpretations, but that's another reason one might at this point choose to go with the federal act as opposed to the Uniform Trade Secret Act. The reality is at this point so far, we're seeing in a number of cases where plaintiffs will sue under both. So they want to be in federal court for whatever reason. Maybe the possibility of getting extraterritorial jurisdiction over a foreign actor, or simply what's perceived to be a better judicial draw, a better judge, but yet be able to avail themselves of the body of law under whatever state act and whatever state common law they've chosen to sue under. Trade secret identification and specificity, that's a very strong requirement in California. So far, it's not so much in the cases that have chosen the DTSA route. But in California, I think you're going to find that those become essentially merged and that will be adopted by federal courts. Time will tell. Justin's already been over the inevitable disclosure doctrine. The federal court initial disclosures will happen. State court, That's not a requirement. Federal courts sometimes, and I stress that really strongly, sometimes have more forgiving evidentiary standards on a TRO posture. So whereas, for example, in California state court, a judge may be more inclined to require that evidence be completely authenticated, be a foundation, essentially apply the evidentiary standards that you might on a summary judgment. There are sometimes federal courts won't do that, but I really think the best practice is to plan that the federal court will act just like the most stringent of state courts. Smaller juries in federal court, but must be unanimous federal court, more likely to have a judge for all purposes. So the judge that's looking at your complaint for injunctive relief, also more likely than in a state court, is going to be your judge for everything. Pick your defendants wisely. Corporate versus individual defendants, do you have jurisdiction over both of them? Who's going to put up the bigger fight? Is this really a rogue employee bad actor, and the new employer really is not a bad actor, and you want to maintain good relations with a competitor? There's all kinds of factual considerations for that. Obviously, the bigger the fight you pick, the more expensive it becomes, and the harder it is to prosecute your case. Again, jurisdiction over defendants. Can you get it, particularly if there are foreign entities involved, and what are their touches in the United States? The convenience of the form. Do you want to bring defendants in who might credibly be able to say, look, you've sued me in California federal court, but I really am not subject to jurisdiction here. Any operative contracts, informed selection, choice of law, arbitration provisions, it's often the case, hopefully, that these individual defendants will be subject to non-disclosure agreements. And if those agreements require that suit be made in a certain court applying a certain law, or, for example, arbitration, that obviously needs to be taken into account and well understood before you move. Balance access to discovery with optics of potential overreach. This is a theme that's always present in these cases. The discovery that you might get on an expedited basis and from a particular defendant has value, but if you're just trying to get discovery out of the corporate defendant who you haven't really established a link to, even using circumstantial evidence, do you really want to name them as a defendant just so that you can say, hey, they're a defendant, they are subject to immediate deposition or whatever the case may be? And then finally, avoid interpleader hangups. Try to structure your complaint at the outset such that it's not really going to be subject reasonably to challenge for a missing party. Plead the best claims. You want to avoid the kitchen sink route if you can help it. You don't want to have a complaint that's put together in haste that might reasonably be subject to a motion to dismiss. So if you're in federal court and your claim is not frankly well put together, defendant might reasonably argue, look, Your Honor, you can't grant injunctive relief here for all the reasons that they would typically argue. And they might say, by the way, this is garbage and here's why we really want an opportunity to attack this complaint on its merits. Why allow for the confusion? Seek TRO only if, on those claims for which it's required. Only seek injunctive relief, for example, if you can, on the trade secret claim, and don't do it on something that is a tort or a more tertiary claim that really doesn't have high value. What if you miss a fact that casts a cloud over your case? Don't forget to check the local rules. Can't stress that enough. Whether in federal court or state court particularly, it matters what their processes are for ex parte relief. And if you don't do it correctly and you've spent all this time putting together particular forms and declarations in your papers and you get ready to pull the trigger, it can be damaging, to say the least, to have to tell your client, well, just kidding. We're going to have to wait 72 hours because we forgot to look at the local rules. Early discovery. This is a issue that often clients will take a very close look at and decide whether or not to make that ask. And what I mean by that is asking for expedited discovery at the same time you're moving for ex parte relief, that is the TRO. It can be an extremely valuable tool because you need additional information, for example, between the time you hopefully get your TRO and the time that the preliminary injunction hearing is set. And so there are these bullet points that I have here that I won't, in the interest of time, walk through each and every one of them, but these are considerations that should be well thought through when thinking about early discovery, whether it's necessary, and here are some of the values. With that, I know I just blazed through that section, but I wanted to make sure we got the what I think is really important information that you heard from Jim Vaughn as to setting aside the technical terms, just giving you a toolbox of information that you can use that oftentimes is very critical to trade secret litigation. Again, the cases are almost always based on circumstantial evidence. Sometimes you'll get a particularly dumb, frankly, misappropriator who makes it easy for you. But the more valuable the trade secret and the more sophisticated the misappropriator, really proving up your case on the front end is incredibly important. And in doing that, well over 90% of the cases that I've litigated over the last 5 years, and frankly 10 years, involve electronic discovery and forensic information, because that's the way information is created, stored, and transmitted. And so it's really important to understand that in building your case and making the best use of that information, because the majority, not all, but the majority of trade secret lawsuits that are filed really do tend to settle out at the preliminary injunction phase. If you go through, you get your temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction that is useful in what you've asked for, most defendants, not all, will at that point roll over and try to get something done and be done with it. And it's a very time-intensive and can be an expensive process. So one of the big takeaways is spend the time, if you have the time, and you really should make the time, to do it correctly. So I think I've addressed a couple of the questions that we had. There was another question that was asked of whether or not it is realistic to cut off a departing employee's access to information 2 weeks before he or she leaves. And that's really, I think, a business judgment as opposed to a legal determination. But I would say this, if the person has given 2 weeks' notice and you think they are high risk potentially for misappropriating trade secrets, consider paying them through their end date and asking them to leave professionally, or just dismiss them if they are particularly high risk. Ultimately, if your trade secrets are at issue and you think they present a significant risk for misappropriation, yes, that would be my legal determination that, yes, it is realistic to ask them to leave early and not have that particular risk present. That is them being physically present on the premises with access to your computers to misappropriate data. With that, I know there are a few other questions that we will certainly get to. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your questions. We will follow up with those who have asked questions that haven't been answered. And I hope you have enjoyed this and it's been informational and that you have a great rest of your week. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This concludes today's webinar. I just want to point out that the contact information for all of our speakers today is also listed on your screen. Thank you for attending, and you may now disconnect.